Gentlemen, you have before you a proposed Judiciary Committee resolution that's been asked for us to sponsor by Senator Rohde. I need a motion for us to sponsor this, and I need... You certainly may read it.
You don't laugh, though.
This is relating to the local purchase of plastic milk bottles by the Matanuska Maid Dairy. So late in session, we're doing heavy-duty deals.
Don't they have to abide by the procurement statute?
Yeah, they did.
The fair?
The guy in Washington underbid the...
Even with the 5%?
Seven.
To buy the milk bottles directly, does that mean that the bottles are coming from the same place and this person is a middleman, or was it a manufacturer?
Well, this is a manufacturer. He actually manufactured these bottles on Post Road. You guys aren't reading the newspapers. This is, let the record show, Senator Pierce has joined the committee. We're four strong. Senator Pierce, we're under debate as to whether to introduce this resolution as a Judiciary Committee resolution at the request of Senator Rohde on plastic milk bottles.
Where's Senator Rohde?
He's coming. He's on his way, but we were just getting started here.
Well, I heard, you know, are we kind of informal discussion now?
Yes.
I heard such compelling arguments the other day from the interest that say don't direct free enterprise. The enterprise entities that we own, like railroads and dairies. And
the dairy has not been a free enterprise entity.
Wait a minute. Now we're going to tell them to pay more for the bottles?
We passed it out of the Senate twice to sell the dairy.
And all we get special house resources by the employees of the dairy.
What was that?
Senator Rohde has requested that we introduce this resolution. Does anybody have super heartburn over this?
How many of them are there?
And that's what they're afraid of getting these jobs that they're so. That is why they're selling the dairy. I said house resources twice.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's about the introduction of this resolution. Is there anybody who has super heartburn over this?
Why don't we just say it for the matter of
It's not that I have any heartburn, but it's just I don't know what they have to do.
You're telling they got to Osco.
Senator Rohde,
I would not deny Senator Rohde's request.
I don't know why he didn't stick in underneath the Economic Development Committee.
What can I say? Would you rather it be the Economic
Development Committee? Can I
introduce? Do you have an Economic Development
He's chairman of it, didn't he?
That's the Banking Committee.
Banking and Economic. Can I introduce Bill?
He feels that a special committee can't do that.
They can if they do it through rules. I do have a question now. We are telling them that it's our right to go outside and buy milk. It's a process. And I don't understand why we are going to tell them that they can't go outside and buy plastic milk.
Okay, because it's not all right for me to go outside and buy the milk. But we'll wait for Senator Rohde to talk about that. Senator Bill 480 is also Senator Rohde's. Oh, Senator Rohde has
Madam
joined
Chairman,
the committee. We are in full strength, let the record show. Senator Rohde, we have got your proposed Senate resolution under discussion, and certain members of the committee wanted to ask you some questions about the milk bottle resolution.
Yes, Madam Chairman.
Who would like to ask Senator Rohde their first question?
Does each member have a copy?
Yes. Okay. Each member has a copy of the proposed resolution.
Why didn't the Economic Development Committee introduce it?
They're a little queasy about it. Willing to do it, but queasy.
Yes, as a procedural matter, it was unclear what the sponsorship should be. And I think there's no question about, actually, no question. It seems to be a reasonable topic for resolution, to go to the body. And it's one that, as I look around the table, affects all of our constituents. And I know, Senator Szymanski, you strongly support local purchase.
After you amended it all out of the other corporations, how come you all of a sudden want to push it on this one?
That seemed to be the topic of discussion.
I see. I would note for the record and the edification of my distinguished colleague that it was not my amendment that I would disclaim any responsibility. And as I've told the maker of the amendment, there is many a time when I wish she had not made that amendment.
Oh, we're just saying
it. Senator Bates and Senator Szymanski have crossed swords on that.
Oh, we agreed, though.
We ended up on one. If they're round shaped and they got an axle and they run down the track.
Okay, guys, Judiciary Committee, I don't hear any super complaints. Mr. Christensen will introduce this as a Judiciary Committee resolution. Senator Rohde will carry it.
There's no formal record.
Okay, Senate Bill 480. Senate Bill 480 is the first bill up, then we'll do 252, 519, and 414, holding 457.
Did the members receive a copy of the memorandum on the attention deficit disorder resolution?
I think we lost, you think you lost this on that?
No. Another proposed resolution having attention deprivation or what?
I was for next.
Is this another proposed intervention?
It's more dairy stuff.
Is that dairy?
Yes.
I guess. Okay. I don't have them with me, and I will get copies for the committee. My apologies.
Sounds like so, attention
deficit. Almost everyone here has had constituents at one time contact them, you know, about the question of attention deficit disorder and how whether the school boards have been across the state have been complying with the requirements of federal law. Senator Fakes is a former teacher, is probably more familiar with this issue than the rest of it. It is a recognized educational concern. And
what is your resolution do?
Request the Department of Education to review school district compliance with federal law with regard to attention deficit disorder, particularly Public Law 93-112 and 93-142.
Okay, there's a group in Anchorage that's accusing the school district of not following through on their federal mandate on this program.
So, well, we approve this introduction right off the bat.
Well, I think that's what Senator Rohde is asking.
My apologies for not having copies. It's very straightforward. Because the allegations have been made, and I don't know what the facts are, quite frankly, but I think that the Department of Education would be.
Okay, why don't we do this? Why don't you have Mr. Christensen make copies for everybody so they can see it, and then we'll bring it back up and see if there's any complaints. Next, though, we have Senator Rohde has requested Senate Bill 480, an act relating to limited partnership derivative actions, come before us. And basically, on this bill, in 1949, Alaska adopted the Uniform Limited Partnership Act. And there have been several amendments or revisions to that act. In 1983 and 1985, 38 other states have adopted these revisions, and Alaska has not. So what you have before you is a bill that would adopt the revisions made in this Uniform Act that 38 other states have adopted, and we are being asked by our good colleague to adopt these resolutions. And Senator, do you wish to give any more overview on this before I call for a public hearing?
Madam Chairman, you've stated the facts very well. The Uniform Limited Partnership Act is very important to business in Alaska and across the country. The Commissioners for Uniform Laws do on occasion revise the laws. Occasionally a state will not pick up those revisions for one reason or another, and we have not with regard to derivative actions, and it seems appropriate that we do so to preserve as much harmony as possible between the other states. Also, it addresses an area of the law that is somewhat unclear, and this clarifies the law, and we would certainly be, and I think in a reasonable fashion.
Well, I wish I knew what you were saying.
Well, it solves the problem by specifically giving the limited partners versus the general partner, the right to bring an action against someone in the name of the partnership if the general partner has refused to bring action. Some states have allowed to do this under common law. If you're in a limited partnership, you basically don't have as many rights as the general partner in that partnership. One of the rights that you don't have in our state is to bring suit in the name of the partnership if the general partner refuses to do that. This would allow you to bring suit as a limited partner in the name of the partnership if the general partner refuses to do that against someone. Our courts have not adopted any common law rights to allow people to do this, but 38 other states have adopted this, and some other states adopt the common law approach through the court system. So Senator Rohde is asking that a limited partner be given the right to sue on behalf of the general partnership if the general partner refuses to sue. In this state, what you have to do is give 6 months' notice to dissolve the partnership, to get out, or to resign your partnership.
Yes, yeah. And the common law remedies are unclear. The Supreme Court of Alaska has expressed a preference for the legislature defining the rights in question. The derivative action that is before you now is a reasonable approach. If, for example, Senator, you were in a limited real estate partnership, oil drilling partnership, transportation partnership, you really would have that many rights under common law. And that was one of the reasons that some people have used them. And this would give you more rights as a limited partner particularly when there's been mismanagement in your opinion of your limited partnership.
Yeah, let's say the general partner mismanaged something, or you think that they have. Right now you couldn't sue.
I didn't realize you could mix general and limited.
Well, you can't. The general partner has essentially 70% of the rights, and the limited partners have 30.
So anytime you have a partnership that has an assignment of ownership exceeding 51%, then you have general partner. That becomes a general partner, and a limited partner somebody that has minority stock.
I'm unclear if it would apply to that, but most limited partnerships are there. You may be able to have a common law limited partnership, but most limited partnerships are stated as limited partnerships per se.
But I didn't know that you can mix limited partners with general. I thought a general partnership was full power to each partner.
It is.
Yes.
Okay. And then you can have general partnerships mixed with limited partners, so you can have like four partners. Two are general, two are limited.
Don't we more often get into it from the other direction?
It's no,
limited liability side of partnership.
Normally you have one, one general partner and a number of limited partners. Yeah, that's the more common situation. I presume it's technically possible to have several general partners and several limited partners underneath that, but I'm not sure. I certainly wouldn't state that.
Are law firms structured that way?
No, it's almost always with regard to economic ventures. Fishing, real estate, oil drilling, those things where you need to collect capital and then use that capital by, have that capital used by a general partner in terms of, for that economic venture. And the problem this bill is seeking to address is the fact that the limited partners, if things begin to go badly, have so few remedies that they are really helpless. They can get in, but they can't get out.
Well, does the limited part, the limited side that I thought, for example, if you've got five people get into this building and one of them owns 50% of it, and the other four each own 12 and a fraction percent of it, and the building goes belly up and they're all on the loan, you want to be a limited partner in the sense that you want your liability to be limited to the extent of your investment. A lot of the Anchorage limited partnerships prior to the crash weren't limited. They were only limited on what you could gain, but not on what you could lose.
Let me tell you all about that sometime.
but how does that apply to what we're talking about? Is that the same kind of limited partnership you're talking about?
Unless the building was set up as a limited partnership, it would be. But many of them are full partnerships with different partnership shares.
But in those cases, if you're a full partner, whether you got 5% or 50%, you can get the whole liability if you are the deep pocket, right?
Yes.
So they are not limited partners.
No.
They wish they were limited.
Many people wish very much on the way to the bankruptcy court that they were limited partners in that case.
Is there anyone here to testify on Senate Bill 480? Very exciting bill. What would you folks like to do?
Well, what is the term derivative? Maybe the word throws me a little bit. Derivative action.
It's an action brought by a shareholder on behalf of the other shareholders against the management, as I suppose, the Paris general explanation of a derivative action. It's an action by share owners against the managers of the enterprise. It's most commonly seen in corporate derivative actions that you read about in the papers every now and then, particularly with the number of takeovers that have occurred in the past.
It's just
years.
The wording that maybe I guess throws me a little bit. Limited partner may bring an action in the right of a limited partnership to recover a judgment in the partnership's favor if general partners with the authority to bring the action have refused to bring action, or if an effort to cause the general partnership to bring the action is not right to speak.
Translated, that means you are a limited partner. Your general partner is mismanaging your real estate, and there are actions that you need to take. And you can through this mechanism by going to court be allowed to take those under common law. You might be able to ultimately take them, but it would take you a long time. You'd probably have to sever your relationship with the partnership and establish certain rights, and it's much much more cumbersome.
So you are saying that it is possible to be a limited partner in a general partnership?
Yes.
And then the next point is, if you're a limited partner, and let's say you're one of the guys that threw the capital into it to buy this apartment building, and you think the general partners are not acting in your best interest or the partnership.
They're not collecting the rent. They have traded certain things for the rent that you're not the beneficiary of. All of those things, there's literally nothing you can do with that without this act.
Then you sue the general partners.
Oh, you would sue on behalf of the limited partnership to make sure that they didn't lose, and you would also involve the general partner too, because you're obviously alleging.
In some ways, you're suing yourself.
Yeah.
Yes. You can't do that. That's the problem of relying on the common law. The common law, for example, did not allow a wife to sue a husband because it was a joint enterprise.
We haven't changed that, have we?
Yes, we have.
We need to fix that rule.
Okay. Well, is there any other questions on Senate Bill 480?
Madam Chairman, I would move that we pass Senate Bill 480 from committee with individual recommendations.
Any objections? Without objection, Senate Bill 480 passed from committee with individual recommendations. We're back to the potential Rohde resolution on the Department of Education reviewing school districts' compliance with federal laws concerning learning disabilities, primarily attention deficit disorder. Any objections to the introduction of this concurrent resolution by the Judiciary Committee?
This should set the record straight in terms of that question.
Vince has supported the school district thus far. I don't know why we would stop. Without objection, then we will be introduced. Mr. Christensen, if you will put that resolution in under the name of the Judiciary Committee, I'm sure Senator Roy would appreciate that. We have Senate Bill 252, which is a friend that's been before us. Mr. Christensen, you want to tell us, you were going to research 252. Very good. Where are the representatives? Virginia and Alexis. Okay. Would you come forward, please, to explain 252? 252 is the bill dealing with government retirement systems and QDROs. Virginia. Hi.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We are essentially here to answer questions that might be raised by the committee concerning the effect of the amendment that's being made, I guess.
Senator Szymanski.
Are you familiar with the April 9th letter from Greg Oskus, attorney in Anchorage? Did you get a chance to review that?
Yes, we have.
And he had some concerns, which is hard for me to understand completely, because, again, I feel about as helpless as the previous bill. It's a complicated area to me, and it seems like it's more attorneys than anything else. But he had some concerns that we're not doing it constitutionally, or we may not be doing it constitutionally, and I'm not too sure exactly what that means.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can certainly understand your confusion, Senator Szymanski. It is a very complicated area of law, as pointed out in the article attached to the April 9th letter by Mr. Yerbick. It's an area of law that's kind of in flux right now, and we're not absolutely sure that the exemptions provided by the changes in the Exemptions Act made it 2 years ago would actually provide additional protection in bankruptcy to private pension plans. It's very likely, based on our analysis of that case law, recent case law, that it would not provide additional protection. The amendment that's made and suggested in Section 2 of your proposed committee substitute here addresses a different problem that is, in fact, a clarification that we would feel needs to be made regardless of whether this provision, 017C, does provide any kind of additional exemption for or protection for private plans.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Rowe.
You're saying that the exemptions would, let me, I want to ask you a leading question. Would the exemptions more likely prevail in a public plan as opposed to a private plan?
If you're discussing in a bankruptcy context, unfortunately, I'm not able to answer that question in the state of Alaska right now. We presently, I'm representing the state in bankruptcy court right now, and the way the bankruptcy code is written, every piece of property that the debtor owns at the time that the bankruptcy is filed would be considered property of the estate, with one exception, if that property can be considered a spendthrift trust. Arguably, the various pension and retirement plans that the state has or that an individual have might be considered a spendthrift trust, but the problem is that the bankruptcy court wants to look at the state law defining spendthrift trust. The state of Alaska has no such law. So in the case that I'm representing right now, I'm going to appeal the case so that we can have that question of what defines a spendthrift trust certified to the state Supreme Court so that we then could have an answer as to what the effect would be in Alaska bankruptcy court. I'm sorry, if I've confused you, I'd be glad to try to explain further.
I understand, but...
okay. If we can get back to 252, the way it was first presented to us, this was a bill that would clarify that municipal employees' retirement funds would be exempt from a QDRO unless the person was actually retiring. Okay? We learned last time that state pension funds, the state retirement funds, through an act of Congress, could determine whether QDROs would be allowed or not when the eligibility to retire was appropriate rather than the actual retirement. PERS and TERS have taken the position that the person must actually retire before the ex-spouse shares in the retirement system. Okay? There's a feeling on the part of the municipal retirement systems that the law is not clear, that they also have a chance to clarify their laws and say that their pension funds are not available to an ex-spouse until there's an actual retirement. How did we get from there, which I totally understood, to this proposed CS dealing with a court case? Would you explain that to me? And this letter from this attorney that doesn't look like it's appropriate to what we were dealing with. How did this letter impact this bill?
Well, he was concerned. Let me see if I can. Greg Oskus's concern that he outlined in the letter, both to Grunberg, and he also sent me a copy of it, was related back to what I call the original. But didn't you do the original bill several years ago?
The exemptions.
Yes.
Well, we just increased them, doubled them. Right.
But apparently,
no, we did more than that.
What we attempted
to do was to ensure in bankruptcy that retirement benefits were exempt.
Right. Right.
And so that when someone lost everything, they would literally be thrown on the street. They would at least have their retirement.
I understand. We tried to save their homes too. We couldn't do that in Texas.
Well, we did double our amendment.
Okay. How does that have to do with this now?
Yes, it was. Halford Brody special.
All right, Halford Brody special. How does 252 play into all this?
Apparently, the Supreme Court did something right afterward that changed things around.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
At least with regard to the retirement portion of the bill. Now, the doubling of the exemption still stands.
Right.
It is
my part that got in trouble, and we knew we were on close to the edge. My best information is that, in all probability, there are some potential plaintiffs out there who will attack the law in court at some proper time when the proper case comes up. That's been suggested to me, and I presume both the attorneys from the Department of Law are nodding their heads, so I think we're probably all, got three attorneys agreeing, so that's a start.
But I don't understand a thing. Senator Pierce.
I don't think I understand a thing.
Good, you try, because I'm not getting any trouble.
If, as present, what we're trying to do is add to the exemptions. Present peers have held that if I'm a public employee with the retirement system and I'm divorced, my ex-spouse cannot force payment of retirement benefits until I retire.
Right.
And we're trying to just add more groups, judicial and elected public officers' retirement system, right, to those exemptions. Is it the exemption that is in trouble and that's going to go to court?
Well, it went to court.
Not in the jurisdiction, no.
What's the McKay decision?
If I may answer that question, Madam Chairman, the McKay decision was a United States Supreme Court decision that was in 1988, and it pertained to law in Georgia that pertained to ERISA. The bottom line of that decision, the Supreme Court's decision, is that as far as the state statute related to or referred to the ERISA Act, it brought it within the federal law's preemptive reach. In other words, the Supreme Court held that the state could not decide that a plan could be treated any differently than the federal ERISA provisions would treat it. And that was the decision in that case.
And how did the feds treat ERISA?
In this particular case, there was no restriction on garnishing of welfare plans, employee welfare plans. There is a restriction on garnishing employee pension plans. So they said that the Georgia law concerning garnishment did apply to welfare plans. The state law trying to exempt them was ineffective. Or just the welfare plans.
Madam Chairman, if I may, my understanding of Senate Bill 252, what it's trying to do, and to answer the letter that you received from Mr. Oskus, I believe that Mr. Oskus' concern is based on this Supreme Court decision. Is this bill preempting federal law? I think that's what he meant by it being unconstitutional. My reading of the bill is that it is not. If anything, it is an attempt to clarify when those funds may be released by the state under the terms of a qualified domestic relations order.
Okay. I don't see the problem with it then. But that is.
Okay, Mr. Christensen, Section 2, where did we get this committee substitute?
For the record, Madam Chairman, my name is Charles Christensen. Section 2 is House Bill 568.
Keep going.
This language was proposed by the Anchorage Fireman's Retirement Fund.
That's what we're doing. Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right, got it. So that's just clarifying the local. Yeah, this is the Barnes deal, right?
Madam Chair, at the last committee, I have notes that I asked Mr. Christensen to look at drafting language. Because the language was unclear and giving the greatest weight of to the people who applied for or secured QDROs in the interim. I don't believe in bringing laws to disenfranchise people in that category. Is it possible, I actually have some difficulties, is it possible to draft 252 so that those people who have applied for or received QDROs or I suppose who will apply for them before the effective date of this act will be allowed to have them?
Through the chair, Senator Rohde, the discussion at the last meeting was could we perhaps grandfather in people who were already entitled to something. You can only grandfather in a right if the right already exists. And the point of this bill is that we're clarifying what we think the law already says.
We can't reverse it.
That, Madam Chair, that makes me a little uncomfortable because the law has been unclear, and quite frankly, you'll get arguments from different attorneys on what the actual meaning of the law is, and I'm not going to try and state a definitive opinion, but we are making a policy decision that from the effective date of this act on, a QDROs will not be allowed until the eligible spouse retires. It seems that we're not grandfathering someone in, rather we're possibly extinguishing rights.
Through the chair, Unfortunately, Dave Dierdorf was at our last meeting, and although he didn't offer comments, he talked to me afterwards, and he's our expert on retroactivity over legal services, and his view is that the bill would not affect anyone who has already acquired a right, who has been granted a right by a retirement system, who is already receiving benefits. It could not work retroactively to stop benefits until the eligible person actually retired.
I would like to, Mr. I'd like to make that clear so that we don't take away rights from people who have them. After all, it's really our fault. If the law is unclear, we're the ones that write the law, and we shouldn't penalize those people who have accrued rights because of the laws we've written and gone back and said, well, we didn't like that. We should have done a better job, and you're going to suffer the consequences of our draftsmanship.
Mr. Christensen, didn't we conclude that we could do a letter of intent so stating what Senator Rohde just stated?
No, Chairman. It would be difficult to draft a letter of intent that took into account what the committee wants the law to mean in the past, or what it thinks it should have meant, or who it was going to affect. I'm not sure a letter of intent would really work in this case.
That's right. We went through all that. See, we don't know what the law meant in the past.
We could.
Would you like to make that decision as to what it meant?
Yes.
Okay. What would you like it to mean?
And I would decide on that it did allow QDROs, because any other decision would extinguish the rights of people who have either secured or either have secured the money or applied for them, whichever the case. But they have exercised their right. It seems inappropriate for us to go back and extinguish that right.
Can I make a brief response to that as it applies to the public employees, teachers, and judicial retirement system, as well as probably the National Guard retirement system? I believe in our in the memorandum that we prepared, our office prepared for the governor concerning the bill that passed 507, I think, 508 from 1988, which made the original changes to the Alaska Exemptions Act. We pointed out that this provision, 017C, raised questions for PERS-TERS. But that we would resolve those questions too, in such a way that the actual definition of QDRO in PERS and TERS would apply. That it was not abrogated by this, and we were not going to apply the federal definition of QDRO to PERS and TERS. And so that is what the division has been doing all along, ever since then. It would not be abrogating anybody's ongoing rights, because if they get a QDRO that doesn't meet PERS and TERS requirements, they've been sending it back. There's nobody who's currently getting a distribution from their non-terminated spouse's account or benefits.
Well, PERS and TERS isn't the problem. The problem
that's,
is the municipal.
We're talking about the municipal fire and police retirement fund, which
that's
is...
That's the problem.
I do understand that. That's why I wanted to suggest here that if you do a grandfather-type clause or grandfather language, that you make reference to the non-state plans. So there's no question that we have to go back. And for that period of time in between the Alaska Exemptions Act and now, the changes made 2 years ago and now, we have to start making distributions, because the QDROs we've gotten and rejected, or they're still pending right now, PERS and TERS.
I was proposing to go into TERS and PERS. All we have, of course, here is the municipal plan.
This includes PERS and TERS.
It's government plan. Governmental plan.
Well, this broadens the definition to say all government plans. But right. We don't have to do it that drafting style. We can limit it to
municipal plans.
Mr. Christensen has done a lot of research on Mr. Christensen.
Madam Chairman, I think the Attorney General are much more familiar with this than I am. We're referring to governmental plans as defined in the U.S. Code, and that doesn't limit it to state governmental plans. It includes state and local plans. Now, if we were to put language in here that said, except as applied to municipal governmental plans, this could then be construed to mean that we're not exempting state plans.
So we've been around and around for days on this.
I see it's a sticky wicket.
Yes, very well said. Very profound there. Yes. This was Mr. Christensen's weekend burden.
And Madam Chairman, if I may, again, that's part of the problem with the letter of intent, is the letter of intent would inherently be stating the intent of a legislature from 2 years ago, which is something that I think a court would pay no attention to, and I'm not sure it really has any effect.
But you could send them a letter, Patrick.
No, wait a minute. This is ridiculous. can't we start from this point forward and say, effective this date, qualified, whatever the...
QDRO.
Applies or doesn't apply to a municipal plan. Nothing in this act is to change the interpretation of the prior law as determined by a court. Period.
Madam Chairman, I think that is basically the effect, although it doesn't explicitly say it, that's the effect of this language. A court is the only body that can determine what this law meant between 1988 and the day this becomes effective.
But there wasn't any problem with the old law as it applied to PERS and TERS. The only problem area that's come up was with regard to municipal plans. Or is there something else that's wrong?
Madam Chair, I think you're correct that there wasn't a problem with PERS and TERS only because we directed the Division of Retirement Benefits to interpret PERS and TERS in a certain way that we think was within the intent of the bill that passed 2 years ago.
But what you're doing is telling them the way they interpreted it was not correct.
What would the impact be on PERS and TERS? What would the impact be on PERS? I assume the impact is going to be small on the muni program because it's much smaller.
Which says,
but
you don't
do you have any idea what the practical impact on PERS and TERS? I hadn't thought of passing that wide. I understand why you should expect it to work, you know, that you're right. So, yeah.
No, it didn't. I mean, the old law did not say that they could cash it in.
The impact on PERS and TERS could be that a number of CDROs that were entered as final orders within the last 2 years could be open to new interpretation. And a number of state employees who are currently working could start having their benefits distributed while they're still working. And that, if I could also point out, the original bill that allowed QDROs for PERS and TERS and for the retirement system as well was passed about in 1986. And a decision was made by the administration, and of course the legislature then passed the bill proposed by the administration, to make QDROs different for the public employee plans than for the ERISA plans, and in that particular respect.
And we're taking advantage of the option that's in ERISA for governmental plans.
Mm-hmm. We don't have that option. Our plans do not allow a distribution while a person is still working.
Right,
yes.
Right. That's the option the federal law allows.
But that's the option the federal law
right.
Is.
Right. We took advantage of that option.
Different semantics, I suppose.
Yeah, that's all right. What do you think, Senator Halper?
I'm sorry.
Is the existing law unclear with regard to PERS and TERS as of the passage of Senate Bill 508? You interpreted it one way, but it said state plan.
Madam Chair, in our bill review letter, we indicated that because there was a specific definition in PERS and TERS particularly, defining QDRO that was different from the federal definition, and since the federal definition by its terms does not include governmental plans, we would recommend that PERS and TERS continue to apply the law as it appears in Titles 14 and 39, defining QDROs for those plans, those systems.
Which makes sense.
But we pointed out that the language in 508 did call that into question. We felt that we could defend it if it came up, but it was called into question. This language in Section 2 here would clarify that, that PERS and TERS have been doing the right thing. And it would also clarify a more serious situation with respect to the municipal plans that did not have a statutory or perhaps an ordinance authority to define QDRO.
Simple question. The Attorney General's office likes to propose to the associates to solve some of your problems, potential problems.
I'm sorry, would we like to?
Is the Attorney General's office endorsing the proposed committee substitute for 252?
Madam Chair, I believe that on behalf of the Division of Retirement and Benefits, we would endorse this as it stands now. Our concern would be over any language attempting to make retroactive or make not retroactive the provision. We'd like to characterize this strictly as a clarification.
Mr. Christensen, if we adopted this committee substitute dated 459, further questions? Senator Stanton, will you adopt the committee substitute?
Yeah, I move we adopt the CS instead.
Is there any objections to the adoption of the 4590 CS for 252?
I still don't.
You what?
It's fixing what you guys should have done better last.
Are you objecting to the adoption of this committee substitute?
No.
Without objection, the committee substitute dated 4590 for 252 has been adopted before us. Further questions? Senator Halper.
I just cannot believe that there is no way to separate the municipal issue from the state issue. And
Senator
we've been
Halper,
told 10 different ways is okay. That there is no way.
Senator Halper, would you like this bill in subcommittee until Thursday so that you also can try?
I don't ever want to see this bill again.
Does that mean you're willing to make a motion?
No, I am not. I think the bill should die.
Mr. Christensen.
Madam Chairman, if I may make one more comment, yes, there are state laws which specifically adopt the definition of QDRO for traditional firms. Anchorage Assembly has adopted a municipal ordinance defining QDRO for the Fireman's Retirement Fund, and it defines QDRO in the same way that the state plans do. Since federal law currently exempts government plans, we would then look to the Anchorage Municipal Code to determine how QDRO is to be defined. So this whole issue is really sort of academic. We're I think, clarifying. I would assume also that once we pass House Bill 508 back in 1988, that any other municipal plans that existed probably also adopted a specific definition of QDRO. That's what caused Anchorage to do it, passage of that bill. So I don't really think there are any people out there who are going to be affected.
Does that make you feel warm and fuzzy? Is there further questions? Senator Szymanski, do you have a question?
No, I was just going to say yes.
If you people, do you want this to die? I mean, we can do that.
No,
Senator Szymanski.
No, I just make a motion to move out CS for Senate Bill 252, Judiciary Sticky Wicket, the individual recommendations.
Is there any objections to moving 252? Okay, without objection, 252 Judiciary will be moved.
There's no way to fix and do what we want to do.
Basically, we hate this bill. I can just tell. Okay.
I think attorneys can figure out a way to do something we want to do.
They tried. Right. Mr. Christensen tried for days to do this bill. Would you call?
And I even worked on it on Thursday, and I couldn't figure out
how to do it. Committee will stand at ease
for a few moments,
please.
I'm glad my bill. I used your bill to carry my bill because I already sent mine.
Bill 414, an act relating to commitment to treatment programs for pregnant women who are alcoholics. This relates to the involuntary commitment of a habitual alcoholic. Currently, such a person can be committed to a treatment facility under two circumstances. If the person threatened, attempted to inflict, or inflict physical harm on another, and that unless committed, the person is likely to inflict physical harm on another. That's one way they get committed. Or number two, the person is incapacitated by alcohol. That's the second way. This bill, 414, adds a third circumstance to the involuntary commitment statute in which there is an alcoholic and be involuntarily committed if the person is pregnant and unless committed is likely to harm the fetus by continued use of alcohol. We have requested Ms. Shaw from the Attorney General's office to come and briefly go through the bill's constitutional and legal problems. And Ms. Shaw, if you will do that, I think we all have an idea, but I would like you to set the record straight and then see if there's any suggestions for fixing the bill.
Well, I'm Elizabeth Shaw, I'm the Assistant Attorney General. Elizabeth Shaw, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Alaska. And I have seen the bill previously when it was first brought before the Senate or brought before your body. However, I did not review it at any great length and actually have only reviewed it over yesterday and portions of today. I got out my trusty constitutional law book and started sorting through it for anything similar. And of course, we're well aware of the issues that have come before the U.S. Supreme Court recently regarding abortions. Perhaps you're aware of the bills, the cases regarding right to refuse treatment and the consent to treatment and mental health cases. The general issues of medical care have been before the court rather consistently recently. Looking at constitutional law is, as Tribe describes it, more or less a smorgasbord of looking at philosophy, social history, sociology, all our really emotionally held beliefs about what our country is about and what has been identified as the right to privacy or the right to personhood is about. And the right to privacy is, as defined by constitutional scholars, is not just the right to be left alone, but the right to express ourselves, express our personhood, how we dress, how we look, how we act. However, our right to privacy or personhood isn't so sacrosanct that we may harm others in pursuit of our own desires. And that's seen in the public health area when, under the public health police power of a state, and usually these are rights reserved to a state, they're not federal rights, we can require someone to have an immunization to prevent the spread of disease. Or we can require someone to be civilly committed to a hospital if they are mentally ill and as a result are dangerous to themselves or others or are gravely disabled. And all these things are defined in the statute. So the right to be ill when it affects others is circumscribed by the society's right to protect itself or to protect people who cannot protect themselves. One of the basic, of course, problems that we see with the particular proposition before us, the bill before us, SB 414, is who is being protected. And one of the most difficult questions then would be, does a fetus have a right here in the state of Alaska? I think a review of the paper prepared by Mrs. Weeks, Maureen Weeks, a legislative analyst, is helpful in looking at this. Because there is little law in our state of a positive nature, another case law where we've had someone bring suit regarding whether or not a fetus has rights. But generally speaking, both within the criminal law and the civil law, we do not recognize fetal rights. We recognize a live birth as, at that time, rights attached. And the Constitution protects individual rights. There is an analysis on the non-numbered page, or maybe the page is up in the right-hand corner, but in Mrs. Weeks' analysis from a Wisconsin medical ethics program, in which if you are looking at how you weigh the rights of the individual, personhood, or privacy as against the rights of society, protect those, and let's assume now or presume that somehow you wish to change the law as it stands in the state of Alaska and recognize fetal rights. If that were something the legislature wanted to do in the context of alcohol, involuntary alcohol treatment, you might want to look at whether there is, as it points out here, a high risk of a serious permanent damage to the baby if we did not intervene. And the information from, and I'm drawing this from the position paper of the Department of Health and Social Services, states that there's about a 30% to 50% chance from a heavy chronic abuser of alcohol that the child will have some kind of deleterious effects of various degrees from the use of alcohol. Second, would there be a low risk of harm to the mother? Well, we could be incarcerating her, and I use that term not in the sense that we would put her in jail, but perhaps repeatedly during the pregnancy or for up to a period of the full 9 months, and perhaps for repeated pregnancies. Thirdly, is a recommended treatment going to provide a clear benefit for the fetus? And that is not clear. When one looks at the constitutional law regarding abortion and when the state has a right to intervene in a private life, regarding whether or not a decision can be made about an abortion, although the trimester approach is perhaps waning as far as the legal arguments go with the U.S. Supreme Court, it still stands. It has not been overturned. And if we're looking at alcohol treatment, perhaps the first trimester is more important than the third trimester. And at this point, whether or not the state would want to start intervening at the very at conception, basically, with someone who's a known alcoholic would be problematic, and perhaps problematic from a constitutional sense as well. There was a question when you were off the record as to whether or not an excessive use of alcohol by a male before conception has any effect on the child. And in fact, there is a study from Wisconsin that there is a lower birth rate consistently among children whose father has indulged in binge drinking before conception. So we do have some information now coming out, not a great deal, regarding how abuse of alcohol by a male could be involved in affecting the fetus or the child, the live birth. This bill does not, of course, cover locking up men who are sexually active and alcoholic as well, or requiring them to use contraceptives. And that particular issue of using contraception has been covered by the U.S. Supreme Court as well as a right to privacy as to whether or not the state will intervene in the use of contraceptives. The fourth, and I think I've covered the fourth article here, in order to maintain consistency with the Roe decision, the fetus must be viable. That's the fourth thing within these four factors that this particular bioethicist looks at. And in fact, we would be looking at, or this particular statute or a proposed statute would not be concerned with viability, but actually if you want to have benefit, you would look at what a phase that we would all agree is a non-viable fetus. The decisions of regarding constitutionality, when the court starts looking at them, are going to look at the effect and also at the incremental effect of decisions of this type, that if there is a drift that results in sort of a cumulative result, obviously the state may intervene under its police power to protect citizens that cannot protect themselves. Here we have a case where we do not have recognized fetal rights within our state, so arguably the state may not intervene at all until it makes a decision, or affirmatively, I would hope, makes a decision that it wishes to do so rather than inferentially by the fact that this bill says that you can lock someone up or treat them involuntarily, and I would imagine that would be in a detention situation from the time of conception. The state may voluntarily confine a person for mental health treatment. That person also may have a right to refuse some kinds of treatments. The court may as well look at, when they're looking at the result of this, as the state's intervention resulted in benefit, would be what treatment are we talking about? Is it just abstinence that we're looking for? What kind of monitoring we have? And what kind of detriment may come from this? And in fact, there obviously would be concern that a woman who believed that she might be pregnant and also had a problem with alcohol would avoid prenatal care rather than taking the chance of being committed to an alcohol treatment program. There also could be the chance that she would determine to have an abortion rather than to go into detention. That could be a solution if one did not want to be detained for 6 to 9 months. And there is of course the problem of, do we have enough resources, and are we actually going to be able, perhaps this isn't constitutional, I'm into an area that's not constitutional law, but are we actually able to do what we say we're going to do? And one of the problems I have found as a practitioner in the area of involuntary commitment for alcohol treatment is that there aren't beds available. So that even if everything was constitutional, which this is constitutionally suspect, would we be able to provide the services necessary if we were to bring someone before the court? You should be aware that procedurally the Act, although I don't believe in this particular bill it shows all the provisions, does provide for a jury trial. And in Mrs. Weeks's memorandum, it notes that on two different occasions here in Juneau, we attempted to use a jury trial to a lack of success. Two different attorneys, so two different approaches. It's very difficult to prove that someone is unwilling to accept treatment after they've been sober for several days to several weeks before the time of the hearing, to prove that they would not accept treatment on a voluntary basis. However, the liability issues here, the fear that that treatment programs might have, as well as jurors might have, and if they were to allow a woman to leave a treatment program prior to the birth of the baby, would one more drink be the last drink, would be the drink that would actually affect the child, so that there might be a tendency to even be more harsh with the release and discharge for women than for men from treatment facilities. Of course, a difficulty involved in having persons in a treatment facility for lengthy periods of time when a treatment program is usually for 28 days, not for 6 months. We only have one long-term treatment facility in the state that I'm aware of, that's Nugent's Ranch, and I'm not sure how many beds are there, but it may not be appropriate as a place where women would spend lengthy periods of time and receive prenatal care. However, in looking at the bill strictly from a constitutional standpoint, there are quite a few questions one would have, and perhaps the answers that we give have something to do with our own values, but the court also looks at them from societal values as well as from the law as it's written now. And this particular statute, the Department of Law would see as being highly constitutionally suspect as written. As to how you could rewrite it to make it less suspect, well, that question wasn't asked me yesterday, so I think there would be difficulties in rewriting it within the context of the Uniform Alcohol Treatment Act, which was never looked at as being a public health bill to help infants or help fetuses, so that you would have to look at the totality of the Uniform Alcohol Treatment Act and whether or not it in itself provides the kind of framework that you need. Is a 30-day treatment necessary, or is a 30-day treatment what is really of benefit to the fetus? And And I suspect that writing into the Uniform Alcohol Treatment Act issues about fetal rights is not an appropriate place for it to be written, and that the legislature may not wish at this late date to consider such an important issue, certainly in the context of alcohol treatment. I really have nothing more specific than that, other than the recommendation that it not be done within the Uniform Alcohol Treatment Act, as it is now written, to deal with this problem. Taking also into account this does not cover drug abuse, it doesn't cover drug abuse of illicit nature or prescription drugs. Obviously, the parade of horribles that comes before us is, if we look at this, what about smoking, nutrition, getting enough sleep, getting too much exercise, all those kinds of things that can affect fetal development and a child's chance at birth. Without a look, perhaps initially, at our child abuse reporting, as well as the kinds of services that we provide through social services to children of families where alcohol and drug abuse is a problem, it appears that in some of those areas it would be more appropriate, at least initially, to address the problem there than it would be in the incarceration or the detention of women with problems with alcohol.
In order, the first step we'd have to do, and tell me if I'm right, Elizabeth, or not, would be we'd have to give the fetus rights under our statute.
At least as to this particular issue, you would be, it seems to me, be recognizing them, at least impliedly, if not specifically, if you would want to do it specifically.
Okay. And what, and where would we put that? Would we put that under the criminal code?
I would think you could put it right within the statute if you wanted to limit it only to alcohol treatment.
Okay.
That you would put something in here saying we are, for purposes of alcohol treatment, recognizing the right, some type of right of fetuses. I have no language.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Szymanski, then Senator Rody.
A couple things that I was curious about, because it's one of the pleasures of serving on judiciary. You learn a lot about the law in areas that you never even dreamed about, but you hear a lot about being able to do a petition to compel, you know, where you take individuals' rights away and so forth. In here, it. And I guess I've scanned through the news articles that were on the bill, and it talks about, and it doesn't say it in the bill, but the people who can bring the petition apparently are a spouse. Is that in an existing statute somewhere?
Yes, it is in the existing statute under the Uniform Alcohol Treatment Act.
And for mentally ill.
Well, it's actually, there's two of them. There's a Uniform Alcohol Treatment, and it specifies who can bring the petition, a spouse, a physician. There's a difference between an emergency petition and an involuntary petition. And the mental commitment is any person. There's a difference between a mental commitment and an alcohol commitment as to who may bring the petition.
And I guess I want to think about it a little bit as we work on the bill, but we may want to more narrowly define who have a closer relationship to the fetus than as broad as it could be under the current statute. So. We may want to look at that, because the way it is under that current statute, it can be a physician, it can be a relative, it can be almost a concerned party as you go off and get. But the other protection that's in here, and the way I read it is, the physician has to certify within, 2 days of the petition that there is cause, a physician certificate supporting the petition has to be presented to the court.
Well, in the emergency situation, a physician will have seen the person, whether it's a pregnant female or anybody else, and then will sign a physician's certificate, which when given to an approved private or public alcohol treatment facility, then, and if they've got a bed available, which sometimes is problematic, can take the person in for up to 5 days if that petition is endorsed by the administrator of the program. Remembering that my experience is mainly here in Juneau, but I think it's fairly similar in Anchorage with Clitheroe Center.
Okay, is that what we're doing on page one, section one of the bill then? When it says there's a certificate shall set out the physician's findings in support of allegations of the petition?
Yes.
It's referring to the 5-day commitment?
It's referring to the, I believe 190, if my memory serves me correctly, is the not the emergency portion, but a petition was filed by someone. Then the person is required to come in and have a hearing.
Well, it's under 190 is the involuntary commitment of alcoholics.
Right, not the emergency commitment of alcoholics.
And that's the reason I was
trying to figure out, and it doesn't define it in there, the relative or relationship. That was one thing. The other thing that you didn't touch on, which I was curious about, was at what point in time does a custody relationship change between a parent and a child when they become pregnant? Or age majority, at what point in time does it shift? In other words, if you've got a 14-year-old, you're currently...
Control is the issue.
Yeah, I mean, under current existing law, nothing changed today. I got a 14-year-old daughter, she became pregnant. So the time when she's pregnant, I know I've got care, control, and custody and responsible for it, right?
That's correct.
If she becomes pregnant.
You still have that same responsibility and duty toward her.
And do I have the same medical control that I could impose on her?
You mean sign her into a hospital?
Sign her into a hospital, restrict her, right.
Yeah, well, I think
I think you do, but
under
I don't
Parham,
know.
Under Parham, a U.S. Supreme Court case, you can sign your child into a mental hospital. If the psychiatrist is willing to accept the child to be admitted to the hospital, that's based upon the theory that the psychiatrist is acting as an independent decision maker, much as a magistrate or the court might. We might not agree with that in our state. Right to privacy might be more restrictive, but as far as it being addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court, it has been allowable, and that's why perhaps my feeling is that's why we have so many private psychiatric hospitals, because parents can sign their children in. It's called a voluntary admission.
Please, hang on for a minute. It is 10 minutes to 3. We are going to be spending 4:14 the rest of the time, which is about 40 minutes. We will not get to 5:19 today, so I wanted everybody to know as soon as possible. We will take up 5:19 on Thursday. Okay, we will spend the rest of the time on 4:14, so all of you don't have to wait unless you're finding this interesting. Elizabeth, or Senator Szymanski, please continue, then Senator Rohde, then Senator Halford.
And I guess what I'm trying to figure out, now you may figure out where I'm walking with this one, is,
no.
Well, if you've got an existing law that's unchanged, you can do it at a certain, I mean, at what point in time can't you commit? You can take the current 37190, involuntary commitment of alcoholics statute, and implement that to accomplish basically the same thing if you have a child in custody, isn't that correct?
Well, yes and no, because they have to meet the other criteria. They have to be out of control and incapacitated by alcohol or danger to others. If the others is not a fetus and they're not incapacitated by alcohol, perhaps they're a binge drinker, and they may get drunk and intoxicated, but they don't meet the other criteria, they are not going to be committable, and danger to self is not included in alcohol commitment as it is in mental commitments. It's real catch-22 for the suicidal alcoholic.
Senator Rohde.
First, let me thank Attorney General Shaw for the explanation. You did a great job of covering the territory. I can't see how we can make this constitutional when you look at the number of deficits that you pointed out as you went through your analysis, I thought very good. All of those do tend to add up, and then as a matter of public policy, whether it's really fair given all of the other things that can happen to lock up a woman under these circumstances, you don't have to be a lawyer to feel that this approach is somewhat repugnant. More than somewhat, it's repugnant, period.
Do you have a question?
Well,
Senator Halford, please.
How does the state define, under this legislation, pregnancy? And does the state have a right to require a test? Where is the information in this process?
It's not. And that's why the Uniform Alcohol Treatment Act is a difficult place for all of this to be taken care of. There is no requirement that someone have a test. It doesn't say you must be tested if you go to your doctor and have a problem with alcohol. It's no requirement that you undergo a pregnancy test. There's no reporting requirement for physicians that they would have to notify the Department of Health and Social Services, SOTA, if they have someone that was pregnant and it was abusing alcohol. And pregnancy isn't defined here, and I suppose since it isn't, one you would use the common sense definition as is when you are initially pregnant, when there is conception. It doesn't mention anything about actually the viability of the fetus at all. So from the moment of conception, if you are abusing alcohol, this bill would apply.
Wait, Senator. Go ahead, Senator Hopper.
If
in fact, a doctor and a patient had agreed and been tested and there'd been a result of that test, is there any way that the state could require that information to be turned over to the state, or in existing law, is that privileged information?
That would be between the doctor and the patient. It would not be, it's not required for the state to turn it over, nor do I know of any mechanism at this point, absent some change in the statutes, to require a doctor to report it as some kind of child abuse, like under our child abuse and neglect reporting statutes. We expect it to be a live birth. That's not to say that social workers don't keep track of cases where, and we take custody of the child immediately upon birth, but if there's not the requirement of reporting.
Keep going.
Well, what I'm trying to say, and you're not, you know, the next question I need to ask somebody else, but it's either a preconceived notion that's wrong or it's right, but it has always been my notion that the major damage in fetal alcohol syndrome and most other birth defects is early in the pregnancy. And if that occurs before, say, 4 months, when there is no knowledge of that pregnancy, and in fact that pregnancy is a private matter that's privileged, it seems like we never get from here to there.
Well, it also might be the case where the woman doesn't even know that she's pregnant or has not been confirmed. And I think the position paper by the Department of Health and Social Services points out that exact problem, that there may be already a great deal of damage done, although some of the physical growth retardation arguably may continue to take place later on in the pregnancy, but there would have been a lot of damage already.
Further questions to Ms. Shaw? Senator Szymanski.
Well, and I guess you two kind of a little bit confused because you're referring to existing law, not necessarily the statute is. Proposed.
Yes, existing law that might include like the child abuse reporting law.
Okay, because under the existing statute as proposed, and the more you read into it, you know, the public policy call that we need to make is whether or not there's a compelling public interest to attempt to intervene or allow the intervention in a private process or a private relationship. Now, the way the bill is drafted or written, it reads to me that petition says that, it says petition shall allege the person is an alcoholic who habitually lacks self-control, is pregnant, and less committed, is likely to harm the fetus by continued use of alcohol. That has to be certified by a competent physician. I assume competent physician. You guys, you can have an incompetent physician, but the assumption is that that certificate then has to be signed off by a physician, findings in support of the allegations in the petition, which are the allegations laid out in the statute. So it's not like there wouldn't be good foundation. I mean, you would think that a physician is not going to sign off on it and say, guess what? Unless there's some conspiracy that would go on, and that's where the court would have to make a ruling. But so there is a certain amount of safeguard built into it. The big question is then, is there a compelling public interest for us to intervene to protect FAS if we know when and how to intervene? And that gets down to the earlier question, at what point in time can or should you intervene? If it's 6 months into the pregnancy, is that a point of intervention? I don't know. If it's prior to conception, immediately following conception, conception, right?
Conception.
Conception, is what I said. Okay, she usually corrects me, but.
All right, do you have another question for Elizabeth?
But I guess you could do it legally, though, isn't that correct?
Well, I don't. Your analysis, I think, leaves out the fact that whether or not the therapeutic state has enough reason because we're going to give enough benefit in order to intervene is not actually covered here. That it's sort of a surface thing that we say, well, the woman is pregnant and that will be just a simple test and likely to cause harm to the infant. Well, we'll trust a doctor to determine that. But is that going to be sufficient for a court to look at it and say a fetus, the potentiality of life prior to any viability is sufficient to lock a woman up for, okay, say, 6 months.
And I guess that's the question. You just answered it more to the affirmative, that if you're going to strengthen the legal position of it, then what we probably need to do is, one, establish who we're going to protect, in this case, a fetus that's contained, hopefully, or you assume contained in an alcoholic person who has no control and so forth and so on. And we need to put the foundation in here of what the compelling public interest is to protect, so they can be, so it can be protected in courts. The courts can't be, it can't be just thrown out for being an unfair invasion of privacy.
At least on his face. That it couldn't be just on his
face. We need to stick a lot of foundation in.
And I would think at a minimum, and my recommendation would be that it would take a fair amount of thought to figure out how you want to balance those things off.
Ms. Kramer, did you wish to add anything that's already been added? I mean, I'm sorry, yeah. Terry,
yes.
Did you want to add anything else?
Yes, I'd like.
Please, come forward, on 414. Then we have lots of people on the teleconference who wish to testify. That's why I said we'd never get to 519 today. There's like 20 people.
For the record, I'm Terry Lauterbach from the Division of Legal Services. I heard most of what Elizabeth Straw had to say. I missed the very first part. And I commend her for her detail and for pointing out a lot of the problems in the bill. I have one quibble, perhaps, and maybe it's not a quibble, but it seemed to me she left open the idea that many of the questions have pointed out, that maybe the bill could be written in some other way that would make it more constitutional. I am not of the opinion that that's possible. As long as the elements of involuntariness and invasion of privacy are still in there. Unless it's changed to a voluntary treatment program, I don't see a way to make it constitutional. Now let me explain that. As she probably said before I got here, the constitutional issues raised are the right to privacy and the right to liberty. The right to privacy in that you're divulging your pregnancy in some way, and the right to liberty in that you're being involuntarily committed. Now, when the government seeks to affect either a privacy or a liberty right, the courts use a balancing test, the individual interest versus the government interest. In this case, the individual interest being privacy and liberty, and the governmental interest being protection of the health of the fetus. Now, there are many cases in the abortion context that give us a pretty clear idea, an answer, on how the court balances those interests. The bottom line in abortion cases is that the state's interest in protecting the life of the fetus is outweighed by the individual's privacy and liberty rights until around viability. Given that the state cannot constitutionally interfere to protect the life of the fetus, in my opinion, it is highly unlikely that the state can constitutionally interfere to protect the health of the fetus. The balancing test runs in favor of the woman's privacy and liberty interests, even more so when it's not the life, but only the health of the fetus that's involved. Tragic as FAS is, it's still only the health of the fetus. The state cannot now constitutionally protect its life. It's very unlikely that the state can constitutionally protect its health.
How's that?
Well, but let's go back to the sponsor's statement, which is kind of interesting, because if there's a compelling public interest, is finances a compelling public interest?
Pardon me?
Is financial burden of government a compelling public interest?
Not in the abortion context, it never has been.
How about in this context? If
administrative costs and things like that have never been held to outweigh liberty or privacy interests.
If it cost, and I don't have any reason to disbelieve it, $1.4 million to care for an FAS child through its life, public funds, we find government in a position to intercede in that role, but to preclude or prevent that, it's the same as, you know, I get into the seatbelt law too. I mean, you know, that's a compelling public interest that people keep throwing up at you, why you need to wear seatbelts is to protect the public from spending all that money on people with cracked heads. So in this case, there's not a compelling public interest to save money?
It has not been my understanding that money balanced against liberty and privacy wins out. No.
Senator Alford?
I don't know if I like this argument, but then are you saying that it would be okay to protect the health of an unborn infant after the point of viability?
That is probably a little more open, except in the case of FAS, as they pointed out, the damage has probably been done by then. So the government interest is going to be even less because the damage has already been done. So it does sound like a catch-22, but unfortunately that is the way it works out.
So it is correct that the damage is done That's the major damage is early, or is it not? Can I
That's
hope
my
I have somebody that can tell us what the effect
Well, it's all theory. The current theory or the conventional wisdom is the damage is done within the first trimester.
I'm afraid it's probably not theory, but I don't know what the answer is. You think it is the first trimester?
Well, if they're saying, if the research is saying that 30 to 50% of these youngsters develop FAS with an alcoholic mother or a binge drinker, that's not 100%. That's 30 to 50%. Now, that's a lot. But that means there's no conclusive evidence that you can say 100% of the time these youngsters acquire this in the first trimester. I would imagine it's like a lot of other things. It's the susceptibility of the child. It's whether they're prone to get it. It's whether the mother passes it on in a certain way and if the child has any resistance or not. I mean, I think you cannot, because these are human beings, everybody's different, you cannot make a general statement. But the conventional wisdom is it happens in most cases in the first trimester, from what I've read with Ms. Weeks's research. Is that fair, Terry?
That's what I understand from what I've read.
Senator, you wish to further on?
I'll ask somebody.
Okay.
And I don't want to belabor it, but
please.
But Senator. I'm trying to figure out whether or not it is possible to make this constitutional and legal. And let me use the analogy, and I guess it's one that was recently relayed to me, and I won't give any names attached to it, but a physician tells me that they just delivered an FAS baby that they're shipping off from Juneau to a hospital for special intensive care and so forth, and the drunken mother comes walking back into the area and says, "But what happened to my child? I can't understand what would have happened." And the physician turned around and said, "Well, you know exactly what happened," and walked away. Totally irresponsible people that we end up, the public ends up with a compelling burden to care for and protect. Seems to me the public ought to have the ability to govern that. If we can, if we assume the responsibility of care, we should at the same time, under the same assumption, be able to set up the same level of protection. Why can't you? Doesn't that make any sense?
Senator, all I'm saying is that this is not a legally permissible thing to do. There are many legally permissible things that the government could do to try to cut down on FAS babies and to increase the amount of treatment that and encourage these women to take advantage of treatment. It's just that this is not a legally permissible way because it inhibits other important constitutional rights.
Terry, thank you very much. Is there anyone, what I'd like to do is just go to a couple of these sites and get some of these folks in. Senator Binkley is going to come and testify, and as soon as he gets here, we will let him testify. I'd like to go, Senator Halpert.
I wonder if I could just ask Marie Weeks a question.
Ms. Weeks, would you come forward, please? Would you identify yourself, Maureen?
My name is Maureen Weeks, and I'm a legislative analyst for legislative research.
Having done the research on this thing, it does appear that there's a really significant question with regard to before the point of viability. But if, in fact, we were able to do something after the point of viability...
The testimony is breaking up and join him.
Thank you. He's not using his mic correctly, but he will now.
I'm speechless.
Answer your question.
The point is that if, in fact, we can constitutionally do something after the point of viability, is there enough potential benefit still available after that point to be worth pursuing legislation if, in fact, we're constitutionally precluded from taking any action before the point of viability?
Well, of course, I'm not a medical doctor. All I've done is read everything I can find on the information. The research that I have read says exactly what Senator Fakes has said earlier, which is that it's all theory, but that people believe that the brain develops in the first trimester, and then the brain develops again in the third trimester. So that if the woman drinks alcohol in the third trimester, she is also liable to harm the child during the third trimester. She may have already harmed it or may not during the first trimester, but it is liable to be harmed during the third trimester.
So there is some significant potential benefit to trying to limit alcohol consumption after the point of viability.
There could be, yes.
Further questions? Ms. Weeks, thank you very much. Let's go to Bethel. Is there someone in Bethel who wishes to testify? Bethel, this is Juno. Are you on the air?
Testifying from Bethel. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Please identify yourself and proceed.
John Hamilton. Thank you for hearing me first. I have a sick child at home, so I have to rush home afterwards. I want to bring out some concerns I have regarding this bill. Some of these may have been addressed earlier, but I just want to present them as Joan Blow, a public citizen. My number one consideration is that this is a gender-specific bill. I have problems with that. I think if there's a fetus involved, there may have been some kind of contact with a male hormone, and so it seems like the woman is carrying all the responsibility for what happened. And she's charged with possibly harming the fetus, which has something to do with child abuse. What happens to this woman when she goes into treatment, maybe sometime later, which happens periodically, and she recovers, she's now ready for the job market, and she has this record on her history as a form of child abuse. And since women traditionally go into helping roles, I'm afraid that she would be automatically disqualified for majority of the jobs that women out here in Bush, Alaska go into. And another problem I have is that the woman can be reported by anybody. It's quasi police state against women, and abusive in that sense that unless you do this, I'll report you to the police, the authorities, judicial system. I have a problem with that. And I think women who have abusive problems normally have a hard time getting in, or we have a hard time dragging them in for prenatal care anyway. So what provisions are there to beat the bushes for the undetected pregnancies? I'm saying that in a sarcastic manner, and it's meant to be. And then if you do carry on with this bill, I want to know, I have questions about treatment provisions. I think the treatment programs we have now are overbooked. I know out here in Bethel, we're often like 3 months waiting list, and they're understaffed, and I wonder about the quality of care. Just because of difficulty in getting manpower to people their treatment programs. And if you're looking at shelters for women, these shelters are crisis oriented, and I don't think they can handle long-term treatment programs for alcoholic women. One of my concerns goes back to the other is that there's an unresolved debate on what to do with an AIDS-positive person. As do we consider them and incarcerate them for having something like a deadly weapon? And I don't think that's been resolved, and here we are proposing to throw these women in treatment. And I look at it as a layman, and I see it as being incarcerating women. Although I have a lot of concerns, and I realize the seriousness of fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol effect, I think there needs to be some alternatives explored before we can put more of our people into the judicial system, where we represent 33% of the criminals already incarcerated, and we don't need any more. And thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Pierce has some questions or comments for you. Senator Pierce?
Actually, thank you, Senator Fix. I don't have a question. I just wanted to follow up on one of the comments that was just made. Last year, I sat during the interim on the Welfare Reform Act task force, and we were trying to revise the child care laws to fit the new federal mandates. And in testimony, particularly from the Commissioner of Community and Regional Affairs, one of the concerns she just mentioned about abusive situations came up under child care, and it is a big concern of mine concerning this bill. We have some entire villages, not just families, but entire villages that are dysfunctional in terms of alcoholism problems, in terms of sexual abuse and child abuse problems. If a family member could hold as a hammer over the head of a young woman, young or older woman, that, and it's usually he, that he was going to take her to the authorities and have her involuntarily committed if she did not accede to some sort of sexual abuse, I think we're setting up a situation that could cause some continuation of social problems that we know we already have. That happens not only in some dysfunctional villages, but also, unfortunately, in dysfunctional families in the urban areas. And that was a primary concern when we were trying to child care statutes. And I think the woman brings up a real good point that we may be involuntarily ourselves setting up a situation which can create even more abuse than we already see in these areas. And that's one of my primary concerns about the bill.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Kotzebue now. Is there someone in Kotzebue who wishes to testify?
No, Madam Chairperson, there's no one here that wishes to testify at this time.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Let's go to Anchorage. Is there someone in Anchorage that wishes to testify? I have Teresa Devlin. Rose, I know you said you had a time constraint, and I apologize if you're not going to be able to testify today, but this bill will be back before us again because we want people to be able to testify that want to. Teresa Devlin in Anchorage?
She's approaching the microphone right now, please.
Thank you.
My name is Rose Prince. I live here in Anchorage, and I'm an Alaska Native woman, and I've worked in the field of substance abuse prevention and intervention for a number of years.